Well, thank you, and welcome to the afternoon session of the Nebraska Court of Appeals. And I'm Rico Bishop. I'll be presiding today, but I'm very pleased to be joined on my left by Judge Francie Reedman, who just couldn't get enough this morning and had to come back. And on my right, and we'll actually have a substitution for her after this first case. And on my right is Judge David Arterburn. So again, welcome, and thank you all for joining us. No pressure, but I heard it was packed this morning. There's a few more extra chairs this afternoon, so those of you who are here, we're going to expect a lot of good questions from you later, but thank you for being here. We really appreciate it. So our first case of the day is Herrink versus Blue Stem Energy Solutions. And counsel for the appellant may approach, please. And I want to say I heard, just overheard earlier presentation indicating sometimes there are appeals and the appellant is the side that's bringing the appeal, and sometimes there is a cross appeal, which means that the other side is also raising some issues on appeal, and we have that involved in this case. So if you hear from both sides complaining about certain things, that's why. Okay, so thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Bill Hargens, and I represent the appellant and cross appellee, Blue Stem Energy Solutions, which I will refer to as Blue Stem. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal time. A deal is a deal. Now that's a phrase that probably everyone in this room has heard, attorney and non-attorney alike. Simple phrase, certainly not a fancy legal maxim, but it's the bedrock of several important legal principles that are dispositive of both the appeal and the cross appeal in this case. Because a deal is a deal, the Nebraska Supreme Court, in the case of Benjamin versus Benjamin, which we cite in our brief, held that where parties to an agreement agree upon a method of valuing an ownership interest, they're bound by that. In the Benjamin case, the parties agreed that a particular owner's ownership interest would be valued, if they couldn't agree upon it, by an independent appraiser that they would both agree upon. They agreed upon an independent appraiser, but one of the sides didn't like the result. So that litigant went out and got his own appraisal. But because a deal is a deal, the district court in that case held that the parties were bound by their agreement. They were bound by the appraisal, by the appraiser they had agreed upon, and the district court would not allow evidence of the so-called independent appraisal that one of the litigants tried to offer. Benjamin's controlling here. In this case, Mr. Herrink and Blue Stem also agreed upon a methodology that would be used in the event that Mr. Herrink's employment was terminated for any reason. They agreed that in that event, his ownership interest in Blue Stem would be based upon a purchase price equal to the fair market value per unit as determined by the manager of Blue Stem in his sole discretion exercised in a commercially reasonable manner.
Mr. Hargens, isn't the issue here the in a commercially reasonable manner was in dispute as to whether he used a commercially reasonable manner or not?
Mr. Herrink disputed that, and in fact, at the end of the day, the jury found that Blue Stem, the amount that Blue Stem had offered, $400,000, was not calculated in accordance with the formula. But that doesn't end the story. Just like a car accident case, you've got elements. You've got negligence you have to prove. You've got causation you have to prove. And you've got damages that you've got to prove. In this case, even if you were to consider the jury's finding, which wasn't before the court at the time of the motion for directed verdict, which is the error complained of here, the fact of the matter is Mr. Herrink still had to offer evidence of a value that was calculated in accordance with the agreed upon methodology.
If a party puts forth evidence after a motion for directed verdict is denied, do we review that or do you waive that?
Your Honor, because we were put to the issue of having a valuation expert testify, we were required to put on evidence. But we moved again at the end of the case, and no, I don't think that waived the motion for directed verdict at the end of all of the evidence or at the end of Mr. Herring's evidence.
But then by that point, there was evidence of a dispute as to what was a commercially reasonable value.
I disagree. Because the valuation expert focused on a traditional market value analysis. Now granted, one of the methodologies both of them used is a discounted cash flow methodology, which everyone agreed is a commercially reasonable method of valuation. But it doesn't absolve Mr. Herring from proving not only that Bluestem breached the agreement, but that he was entitled to a different number. That's exactly how the jury was instructed. And keep in mind, I think this is important, the issue of valuation here was framed by the pleadings and the jury instructions. Mr. Herring did not quarrel with the valuation method. He didn't ask the district court to rewrite it, to reform it, to disregard portions of it. So all three elements, fair market value, discretion, and commercially reasonable, had to be incorporated into a damage number, into a valuation, in order for Mr. Herring to carry his burden of establishing all the elements. And that's exactly the way the jury was instructed. The jury was instructed with a quote from the operating agreement that had the valuation method. The jury was instructed, do you find that the amount offered, by Bluestem was consistent with that? The jury said no. And then the jury was instructed, well, if the answer to that question is no, then you need to determine a number that is consistent with that same formula. And we referred back to it in the jury instructions. And there was no objection to the jury instruction. So that's the way the issues were framed. So we submit that Mr. Herring had the burden of coming forward with a number that took into account the discretion of the manager. He didn't do it. How can I be so bold about that? Well, I asked the expert, point blank, sir, isn't that what the agreement says? Yes. Did you consider the discretion of the manager? No. That's a failure of proof. Now, maybe that seems unfair, but Your Honors, deal is a deal. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Hargens.
May it please the court, I'm Dave Domina. I'm here on behalf of Adam Herring, who is the appellee and the cross appellant. The trial court below did reject the idea that this case is about the art of the deal. It decided the case was about the words in this contract, which include this phrase, commercially reasonable manner. The issue in the case became, did the manager of Bluestem engage in a commercially reasonable method of determining the price offered to Mr. Herring for his stock? When he concluded that process, he offered Mr. Herring $410,000. In the same year, or at least for that year, the same person certified in an income tax return to the United States Internal Revenue Service that Mr. Herring's stock was worth $2 million. The case is not about the art of the deal. It's about the words in the contract. Your Honor.
What meaning can we give in his sole discretion if we also need to give meaning to commercially reasonable manner?
We have to modify the former phrase with the latter. And it is a well-recognized theorem of the court and really usage of the English language that a phrase which follows and is directed at a former phrase modifies it. So in this case, sole discretion did not mean indiscretion. It didn't mean something that was arbitrary. It meant an evaluation that required a process. Counsel relies on Bierman versus Benjamin. In that case, the formula provided that fair market value would be determined by an appraiser, not by a member of the, a party to the contract or a member of the limited liability company. In this case, the position argued for here is that the manager could do whatever he wanted and Mr. Herrick was stuck.
It makes the modifying phrase as you describe it meaningless then.
It makes it meaningless. It negates it. The other thing that happens in this case that was assigned as an error on the cross appeal and that I think is the real life of this case is that the other side here seeks a 10.47% bonus for its underpayment offer and its failure to pay on time. The very provision of the contract that was breached here, that breach having been determined by the jury, allowed the appellant to decide not only this initial price to be offered, but the manner of payment. One of the options permitted was an incorporated reference to an Internal Revenue Code regulation that publishes an evolving interest rate. So when the contract was made, the interest rate wasn't known. The interest rate's not stated in the contract. It was an option at the sole election of the other side. An option is a contract to the extent that it creates a choice for the person who holds it, but it doesn't become a contract closed until it's exercised. Here, the option was exercised at the same instance the contract was breached. Our position is that the other side cannot take advantage of its breach to get a 10.47% break in the interest rate, which is 12% under our statute, not 1.53% as happened to be the case under the Internal Revenue Service's prevailing rate on the date chosen by the breaching party.
Is that because they breached or because of the language of the contract?
I think we win on both circumstances, so my answer is yes, but yes to both. I think we win because the language of the contract didn't specify the price, didn't make it mandatory, and made it an option, and also because it just simply disappeared when the breach occurred.
But isn't that a known bargain for option as opposed to the latitude that's given by the, as far as the first issue is concerned, where the discretion of the of Bluestem here, the other is not to say that wasn't bargained for, but it does put some responsibility on the on Bluestem to act in a commercially reasonable manner. The other provision is just it is what it is.
Your Honor, I guess it
seems to me those are maybe two different things.
I agree that the second provision, the interest rate provision, is not modified by the language commercially reasonable manner, but it's a choice. And it's a choice that occurs after Bluestem decides to purchase. After it decides to establish an initial price, which if commercially reasonably determined, may be binding on us, but we don't know that. We don't have that case before us. So those two decisions come first, and then the interest rate is assessed. What was known at the time was that if Bluestem chose to buy, and if it made an offer that didn't breach the contract, then it could choose the interest rate in the Internal Revenue Code's regulation, or the Internal Revenue Service's regulation. What was not known at the time the contract was made was what that rate would be, or how it might affect commercial reasonableness. Obviously, if there is a dramatic difference between the actual market value of the money or the statutory value of the money and the then prevailing momentary whims of the market interest rate, that can affect the fair market value of the stock because money paid over 3 years isn't of the same value as money paid today. So we think on the cross appeal, the court should conclude that the prevailing interest rate before judgment is 12%, the statutory rate, and that's directed by the decision of the Supreme Court in Y versus Gotch. We think that the post-judgment interest rate, because that isn't a contract issue, it's a judgment rate, it's paid on a judgment, should be paid at the lower rate, which is the rate that was prevailing on judgments on the day that the court entered judgment on the jury's verdict. And that rate was just a little under 6%.
There is a general understanding in Nebraska jurisprudence, right, that when a contract is reduced to a judgment, that the terms of the contract are not relevant any longer. It's now a judgment in terms of interest.
That's right. The enforceable instrument becomes the judgment. The contract has exhausted its purpose. The judgment bears interest thereafter. That we concur with that. So we're asking the court to reject the appeal of Blue Stem, to affirm the trial court's judgment, but modify it to correct the interest rate and impose the statutory prejudgment rate, the statutory post-judgment rate, which is different, both of which are expressed in per diems in our brief. Thank you.
Mr. Domina, I want to make sure I understand your, because the party breached, they shouldn't get the benefit of argument. So if the contract were to say, interest will accrue at 10%, okay? Everything else happens as it happens. Because Blue Stem breached, do they get the 10% benefit?
If it's a benefit, the answer is no.
If it works to their advantage, they don't get it. If it works to their disadvantage, we do impose it.
Well, if it works to their disadvantage, it's still the statutory rate, because the issue would be what are the damages caused by the breach, and the question then would be what is the interest rate assessed against those damages. And so, yes, the contract would be fulfilled by the judgment award, but the methodology of determining that amount is judicial. It's not contractual, so we do think that they would lose the benefit of the 10% rate, and it would be governed by statute on both sides, pre-judgment and post-judgment, for the prevailing party.
So the federal cases that you cited to in your brief discuss this issue of the contract kind of merging into a judgment, and then at that point, if there's to be a statutory judgment interest rate applied, that needs to be specifically, unequivocally stated in the contract. And your position is that is nowhere to be found in this contract.
That's correct, Your Honor. And as you noted a moment ago, the prevailing jurisprudence here is that the judgment is determinative of the rate, and it is a judgment rate. Thank you very much.
Thank you. How much time does Mr. Hargens have on rebuttal?
3 minutes, 34 seconds.
Thank you.
I want to spend a couple minutes talking about the cross appeal and Mr. Herring's effort to obtain a 10.4% windfall over what he bargained for. But before I get to that, I want to briefly address the $2 million reference in counsel's comment. The $2 million that was awarded by the jury here was not tethered to any evidence of value. None. No expert testified that that was the value of Mr. Herring's interest.
Didn't Mr. Agliotti testify about, if even if he used the valuation done by Jamie, the brother, there was like a $1.7 to $3 million additional amount that he would have concluded should have been incorporated into that valuation, and he was critical of Jamie's evaluation because it failed to include some future projects, it failed to include some operating assets and other things. So he provided a rationale for why Jamie's value was under a commercially reasonable value, and he explained the amount more that should be added. And interestingly, you know, the jury came in somewhere in the middle.
2 points. One, he concluded in his initial analysis that the number based on a more commercially reasonable analysis should be $1.7 to $3 million, not more than. That was the alternative. I tried for 5 minutes during trial to get him to admit that that was his opinion of value, and he wouldn't admit it. And then Mr. Domina got up on redirect and said, is that your opinion of value? And the answer was no. So $2 million is between that range, but it's not tethered to any opinion of value.
But isn't the reason he would have had to say no to that is because he was going to give an entirely different opinion on value. He was simply in part one trying to show the errors in the valuation submitted by your client. And then part two was what was to be his representation of the full value of the company.
What he claimed is his first analysis was just an effort to correct errors. But, again, I pressed him. Is that your opinion of value? Answer, no. Reconfirmed on redirect by Mr. Domina. So there is no evidence in the record, tethered to the contract or not, that that was a range of value. The only person at trial that mentioned $2 million is Mr. Herring. If you want to find it, it's in the Bill of Exceptions at pages 334 to 335, and again...
When he talks about the reported value for tax purposes.
Yes, according to a K-1 in closing out his capital account. But he didn't even refer to it as value. In fact, he clarified in response to questions by Mr. Domina that, no, I don't mean that's the value of my stock. So the $2 million is not tethered to any competent evidence of value here.
Well, yeah, he wouldn't want to tether the $2 million because he was seeking an excess of 10.
7 to 10. Yeah. He wanted to go for the gold. So,
but is it your position that that wasn't reliable evidence for a jury to reach a conclusion of $2 million?
It's my position that it was not based upon the contract language because the 1.7 to 3 also, there was no evidence that that was incorporated any discretion of the manager. And it looks like my time's up, so you won't get to hear about the cross appeal from me. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both very much for your arguments today. We appreciate it. At this point, we're saying thank you to Judge Francie Reedman, and we will have Judge Larry Welch, who will be joining us for the remaining case this afternoon.
We get excused, Your Honor.
You are excused. Thank you.